Episode 9. I couldn't make sense of the idea that Slavkin had been held by the Cheka, if only for a few days. When I arrived at his office, Pasha took one look at me, frowned, and broke off from the report he was writing. "Sit down." "No, I mean, I'm tired, but would you mind if we went straight home?" Outside in the silent streets, I told him what Monsieur Beloborodov had said. Pasha nodded, holding my arm against his, and was quiet for a long time. "Much though it pains me to say it," he murmured, hesitating, "I think the time has come for you to go home." "Are you mad? I can't go anywhere until we've found him. You see, I talked to Pilyagin. I'm terrified I said something that might have harmed Nikita." I suppose that was the closest I ever came to a confession, until I began to write this. Pasha dismissed it. "Yes, yes, but where do you intend to look now? You think your Cheka friend will show you the way to Lab 37? And what about you?" "Oh, I'll carry on. I'll work for the revolution, I suppose." He gave me a twisted smile. "I'll find someone else to love." "What?" I was aware suddenly that he was trembling. "What do you mean?" "Don't tell me you didn't know. I love you. I fell in love with you from the moment you arrived in our house. You gave me a look, a sort of considering look, and you laughed. And I'd never heard a woman laugh like that before. I've been trying to make you laugh ever since." I opened my mouth and only a stammer emerged. "I know what you feel for Slavkin," he went on. "I'm not a fool. When I heard about the child, I felt so angry, so furious with him. Then I tried to put my ego aside and think only of you and the child. I've done my best to look after you both. But now I beg you, go back to England." "Pasha." I reached forward, unthinking, and touched his cheek. He caught my hand, and suddenly we were kissing in the middle of the street, and I was crying. And so was he. I knew what to do. At 6 in the morning, I got up and packed a small bundle. I removed a stone from the back of the fireplace and took out the Mauser that Monsieur Korbeliev had left in my care. Dubiously, I blew the dust off. I had no idea how to fire it, or even if it was loaded, but it hardly mattered. "You busy?" I jumped. "Lord Pasha, don't frighten me like that. Not when I'm holding this thing." "Yes, what the hell are you doing with it, may I ask?" "I've remembered something that I think might help Nikita. Meet me in a couple of hours in front of the National." But Pasha grabbed my arm. "No, I'm coming with you now." The first pinkish tinge of dawn was in the sky by the time we reached the National. Pasha took both my hands and gave me a serious look. I knew what it meant. We could still turn around and go on with our lives. "Are you sure?" he whispered. I leant my forehead against his for a long moment. "I'm sure." "So, I'll wait for you here. I'll do what I can about transport. If you don't appear within an hour, I'm coming in to find you." I climbed the stairs slowly to the third floor. I stopped for a moment to regain my breath and slipped into his office. Rosa Gerstein, just arrived at work, was unwinding her scarf. "Rosa," I said hurriedly in an undertone, "please forgive me, but you must leave us alone now. Go and do not come back until this afternoon. I don't want to put you in any danger, and I must warn you, if you alert the guards, I shall have to tell Pilyagin your real identity." She nodded, then took her hat and left. I glimpsed Pilyagin's black, shiny head bent over his desk in the next room. "Rosa," he called without looking up. "Rosa has been called away," I said as I entered. "Good morning, Comrade Pilyagin." He half rose from his chair as if to bar me from the room. "I've nothing to say to you. But if you don't mind, I have something to say to you." I took a deep breath and tried to speak calmly. You should know that I am a spy for the British government, and you have been passing information to me about the activities of the Bolsheviks for 6 months. His expression was almost comical. You're a spy? Am I or not? I know what I would believe if I was the guard in the entrance hall downstairs. Please sit down. He fell into his chair, staring fixedly at me. What do you want? Where is Nikita Slavkin? Pelyagin's face worked. I don't know. I swear to you, I don't know. But you did know where he was taken, didn't you? The Cheka aren't holding him, you said. It took me all this time to realise you meant they aren't holding him now. He said nothing, looking at me coldly. Backing away from him, I opened the door into the corridor and called. Comrade! Pelyagin jumped up. What are you doing? You seem unconvinced, so I'm calling the guard up from the hall to tell him about our lessons, all the information I've gathered from your office. All right? No! He was ashen. Wait! The young guard was coming up the stairs. Did you need me? I raised my eyebrows at Pelyagin. Do we? No. I'll tell you what I know. Oh, I'm sorry to bother you, comrade. We don't need you after all. Thank you so much. The guard's footsteps turned and receded down the stairs again. You'd better be quick, I said to Pelyagin. He swallowed. All right. I don't know much. Only that our boys arrested him that night. He knew they were coming. They'd been questioning him that day, then they let him go. Idiots. They were sent more or less straight back to pick him up. He was taken first to Lubyanka, but after a few days they transferred him. He went to a special place, a laboratory. Lab 37. Pelyagin looked amazed. You knew? Where is it? It's... he gulped. It's in the Church of the Ascension at Kalamskaya. How do you know all this? You put together a case against him, didn't you? I said slowly. Hatred boiled in me. Why? Was it because he humiliated you, that time at the Futurist performance? Or was it because I didn't want to go out for a drive with you? Pelyagin frowned. No, that wasn't it, he said quietly. He sat up. Of course, his line about communism can't exist in this version of the universe was enough to get him thrown into jail alone. But have you forgotten that you denounced him yourself? Ice down my spine. I told you, I said I was mistaken. Don't take it seriously, I said. Oh, it was too late by then. He'd recovered his sang-froid. Why did you think I came to the house that day? I had the warrant in my pocket. By then, you'd all denounced him, one after the other. We could have arrested him 10 times over. Marina Gertler spoke to an agent of ours at the hospital. Volodya Yakov shopped him to the Cheka. Fyodor Kuzmin came to us not long afterwards to tell us that Slavkin was making anti-Soviet statements. It seems as though it was one of the few things that commune of yours managed to agree on. Stop! Pelyagin stopped, with his mouth still open. I began to improvise. How many hours have I spent here? You left me on my own several times, do you remember? I've got so much good information from you, Pelyagin. The British Foreign Office are very happy with you. What information? Numbers in Cheka prisons, methods of interrogation, conditions in prisons, arbitrary arrests. It'll cause quite a scandal, you know. He sat down. What do you want? I just want you to leave me alone. I'll leave now, and you won't send anyone after me. You won't mention this conversation to anyone. You'll forget it entirely. Otherwise, you'll soon be at the mercy of those Cheka officers of yours. He stared at me for a moment, and then he nodded. All right. I'll need your ID card and those spectacles, too. He gave them to me, reluctantly. Just one last thing. When you first asked me to come and give you lessons, was Slavkin already under investigation? He smirked. You were a useful source from our first lesson. I slipped out of his office and down the back staircase. With shaking hands, I pulled my shawl over my head and walked the long way around the building to the Alexandrovsky Gardens. From the other side of the gardens, a gnomish figure was gesturing to me. Behind him stood a cart pulled by an ancient donkey. As I drew closer, I saw Pasha in the back. Huddled down and covered with a blanket, it looked as though the old fellow was simply returning home with an empty load. In whispers, I told Pasha all of it, well, almost all of it, all that I could bear. At the end, he was silent for a moment. "Don't think you're going into the church alone," he remarked. "No, I need you with me. You're going to use Pilyagin's papers. Nikita wanted us all to go to the hospital with Sonia, didn't he?" "I think he did. He wanted to be alone when they came. That's why he shouted at Anna Vladimirovna, and maybe why he didn't want me to stay behind. They would have arrested all of us, I presume. Why didn't they come back for us? Perhaps we'll find out now." At midday, we finally trotted up to the gate of the Saviour at Kolomskaya. Pasha and I clambered out of the cart, aching and chilled, and blinked in astonishment. Since the morning, the sky had cleared. The Church of the Ascension stood out, white as a swan against a cobalt-blue sky, on a high bank of the Moscow River. Behind it, the snowy Russian countryside glittered, and perfectly still columns of feathery smoke rose here and there. Neither of us particularly looked the part, but Pilyagin's photograph was overexposed and printed on poor paper. All that could really be made out was a man with a moustache and spectacles. Pasha put on Pilyagin's glasses and grinned at me. We made our way to the main door of the church.
"Open up, comrades," called Pasha.
A long pause. In the distance we could hear footsteps. A young man, dishevelled and pale, looked out.
"You've kept us waiting," snapped Pasha, stepping inside. "Commissar Emil Pilyagin from the Moscow Special Commission. I have come to inspect your setup."
He led us into the aisle of the church, which was being used as a barracks.
"We were informed that there was a laboratory on these premises," said Pasha.
"A laboratory? Well..." A thin, high sound echoed suddenly through the walls. Pasha turned silently to the young man, his eyebrows raised. He unlocked a small door at the back of the vestry and led us out into the courtyard and a huddle of wooden sheds. We heard it again. More animal than mechanical. My stomach turned over. We crossed the snowy courtyard. The young soldier pushed open the door and yelled,
"Serafima, the special commissioner here."
A tall figure appeared, dressed in black. Her face gave me a jolt. The ancient shrunken look of a woman decades older than her upright posture suggested. After a moment, she nodded slightly.
"Yes, comrades. How may I assist you?"
I had the uneasy feeling that she had seen straight through us. Episode 10.
"Follow me," she said.
On the door of the first shed was a scribbled notice, Laboratoria 36. My heart was pounding. Sister Serafima pushed open the door and we were hit by the stench. I stepped inside and saw people. Half-naked, gaunt bodies jostled together and eyes staring out at us, huge, blank, dirty eyes.
I don't understand," Pasha stammered. "They call it a laboratory,"
Sister Serafima said impassively. "Perhaps in the future they plan some sort of research. For now, these people and those in the two rooms beyond are my charges. They're lunatics.
Have you seen everything you wanted?" "No! We were looking for a scientific establishment, a workshop," burst out Pasha in fury.
"What?"
"Lab 37. We believe that a certain prisoner was brought here. Nikita Slavkin was his name."
For the first time, Sister Seraphima's expressionless mask slipped. Slavkin? Yes, we believe he was brought to Laboratory 37 in January of this year from the Lubyanka. Do you know anything about this? She turned to the young soldier. You may leave us now. When he'd gone, she turned back to us, and her face was suddenly animated. Now, you answer some questions for me. You're not Czechists, for a start. What do you know about Lab 37, or Slavkin? I took a deep breath and spoke. Sister Seraphima, we are not from the Cheka, you're right. Please understand, we are friends of Slavkin's. We were told he was working in a laboratory here, in the Church of the Ascension. Sister Seraphima looked at us, and I was amazed to see tears in her eyes. So, you are Slavkin's friends. The IRT, wasn't it? I nodded. He told you? Yes. So this is where they brought Slavkin after the Lubyanka. She nodded. The baby suddenly began to twist violently inside me. The nausea was so strong I felt myself stumble. Pasha caught my arm and held me. I saw he was crying. But it came out in a wail. Why? Sister Seraphima took a deep breath. When he came here, I thought he might not survive the night. As they dragged him out of the van, he was having a fit. She put her hands on my shoulders. I fed him like a baby, spoon by spoon. He was so weak. Did he tell you about his machine? Oh, more than that. He began to build it again. As soon as he could get about, he went out by day and gathered materials. I found tools for him in one of the old stores. He told me about the IRT. He was terrified that you'd been arrested. He hunted the streets for the papers to check for your names on the list. He felt that if he made contact with you, it would endanger you. Once he went to watch you, to spy on the building from some doorway or other. He came back so sad. I think he was hoping to see someone, perhaps someone who wasn't there. Sonia, my voice came out strangely. She died of typhus the week after he was arrested. Sonia, yes. He did mention that name when he was ill. But where is he now, sister? I don't know. At the end of March, I had to make a trip to the countryside to try to collect food for my patients. I left them in Slavkin's charge. He was the only person I could trust. I came back, and that Red Army filth had wreaked havoc, and Slavkin had gone. He and his machine disappeared. And you don't know where he went? I said, stupidly. Without a word, Sister Seraphima led us out of the cell and through a dank corridor. At the end was a heavy door with two bolts. The sign on the door read, Laboratory Number 37. We stepped inside another long, dark hut. There were many fewer people in here, each sitting on their own bare pallet. They were manacled. Many lay motionless, as if barely alive. These patients are chained because they have consistently harmed themselves and others. It is unpleasant to see, but it's the only possible course of action. Sister Seraphima shrugged. She led us up to a powerfully built young woman who was sitting on her pallet and gazing blankly out of the window. Very gently, she took the woman's hand in hers and spoke to her almost in a whisper. Anna, my dear, don't be afraid. The woman looked at her blankly. These are good people, friends of our dear Nikita Gavrilovich. They want to hear about the day he went away. Anna's eyes swiveled and she caught sight of us. She began to whimper and sidle backwards on her bed. Hush, murmured Sister Seraphima, calm yourself. And so the story of Nikita's last journey was told in Anna's poor, painful voice. It was the day that evil men came in and made misery for us. Nikita tried to stop the bad men. He stood in front of them and he spoke a long time to them, lots of words, all about his machine and the world and everything. He thought they were friends, but they weren't friends. They were laughing at him, and one of them hit him and he fell over. And they said, show us this machine then, and he took them outside, and I heard them say, get in, and he lay down in it, and they did more laughing, and then there was a very loud noise. It hurt my ears so much. She covered her ears to show us, and shouting, and we didn't see our Nikita again.
What did the noise sound like?
It sounded like the air splitting in two. Crack! Like a gun.
And then you talked to the bad men, didn't you, Anna? Prompted Serafima.
Yes. And they said straight out to me, they said, he's gone away in his machine.
The sun was sinking in the sky when we finally saw the railway bridge. Just a moment, murmured Pasha. Before we enter the station, I think we should decide on our plans. We may not be able to talk openly there. We turned our faces to the last sunshine.
The only course for you now is to go abroad. I've heard the Estonian border is open at Narva. We must get to Petrograd and then find out how to make the rest of the journey.
And what about you?
I will accompany you as far as you wish me to.
In Petrograd, we took turns all day to queue for tickets to Narva. The train left the following morning on a 24-hour journey. Around midnight, our compartment fell silent, and I finally plucked up the courage to speak to Pasha. I put my lips up against his ear and whispered as quietly as I could.
I don't want to press you, but I wondered if you would mind very much if I asked you to marry me. I didn't know whether I should ask you, what with the matter of the baby, and of course marriage itself is utterly bourgeois, against both our principles. I quite understand if you refuse. He still said nothing, but I could feel him pulling away from me.
No, I've started this all wrong. Wait, please. It's nothing to do with the revolutionary principles.
I loved Nikita. We both love Nikita. We will never stop loving him. But I made a mistake. I misunderstood what love felt like. Do you see? For whatever reason, I thought of love as something difficult, something I should suffer for. I swallowed hard, floundering. I didn't realise I loved you, because it was just so easy and warm and good.
Suddenly I felt his finger on my lips.
Shh!
No.
No?
My voice rose to a squeak. No, I don't mind marrying you, my darling love, you absolute idiot. We kissed in the darkness, all the way to the border. We were married in Tallinn. The city was battered by civil war, but to us it seemed the epitome of peace. The Korbelivs had friends, perhaps even distant cousins, the Rauds, who had an estate south of Tallinn. Kind, generous people that they were, they housed us for almost 6 months. In the middle of April, she emerged. You emerged. We called you Sophia, for Sonia, and also for the calm wisdom that you seemed to exude. We set up home in London, it being easier for both of us to find work here, and after a couple of years, your Korbeliv grandparents joined us. We spent a good life together, with you, and later your boys, our grandchildren. We were an ordinary family, bourgeois, by the IRT's reckoning. We grew old. Our lives were not marked by any exceptional achievements, if you discount the raising of one clever, serious daughter, who, despite her parents' lack of scientific ability, became a mineralogist and studied for a PhD in rare earth metals and brought up her two sons to dream of social justice. And so, at last, to the reappearance of the vanishing futurist. Books and a feature-length film came out, and several physics departments were named in his honour. Yet no one has ever managed to explain how his machine could have resulted in his disappearance. During Khrushchev's time in power, when so many injustices came to light,
Pasha told me he wanted to try to discover the truth about Nikita's death. I was reluctant. We argued over it, and Pasha didn't bring the subject up again. When you first brought these boxes of papers down from the attic, however, I opened them to find an envelope with a Russian postmark that I'd never seen before. Inside, a printed slip in Russian, in response to your request. Pasha obviously wrote for information despite my resistance and then left the results for me. He knew that when I looked through the IRT papers again, when I was ready to tell you this story, I would find it. It was a last act of love for you, Sophie, as well as for his friend. The printed slip had a header, blurrily stamped in the pale green favoured by Soviet bureaucracy, which announced it originated in the Ministry of Internal Affairs of the USSR. Behind it was a photograph of some kind of form. Stamped in large red letters over the form were the words, "Restricted Information." The truth is that Nikita Slavkin died of a bullet to the head in the filthy backyard of a lunatic asylum. An image floats back to me. The first weeks of the IRT, and all of us are lying together on the lawn at Gargarinsky Lane, gazing at the first stars, and the smell of dry grass is in the air. The end of summer, and Nikita is speaking. For better or worse, we are creating the future here, in our minds. Each time we allow ourselves to imagine a harmonious world, we bring it closer. Just share your thoughts with us. You know the answer, if only you can discover it within yourself. Inside your imagination lies the blueprint for the future. How, why, what you will into being. This is the choice that confronts you and all of us.
That's me stumbling away.
We're in this masquerade.
Both know what the memories bring.
This is the ride.
My guitar is getting detuned because of the cold. But this next song I wrote it after reading The Old Man and the Sea from Ernest Hemingway. Maybe you know it or have read it in school. But that's really based on that book. It's called Tied to the Mast. Between water and wind, underneath a bell jar of stars and treasures of gold on my tongue. So go grab on tight, for there's oceans ahead, knowing time slowly ripples away. I've been searching for islands where decisions are mine, and the sun will rise into the west. So come sink into the light of this dark blue horizon, stripped from all your desires, pleasantly tied to the mast. Pleasantly tied to the mast. And if the water pulls you under, and the sun seems to be out of reach, try to recall that the abyss is only as deep as you want it to be. So come sink into the light of this dark blue horizon, strip from all your desires, pleasantly tied to the mast. And be pleasantly tied to the mast. Be pleasantly tied to the this next song is really about finding, or I think the self-destructive nature we all have inside us, and like finding a balance between resistance against yourself and acceptance of yourself. So I think that's what it's about. But at the other, in the other hand, it's like, this is the first song that I didn't really worry about writing the lyrics that much, or what I was precisely writing about. So It is about whatever you want it to be. So, but it's called Exception. Difference does it make? 'Cause I've seen every shade of blue, sapphire, but cobalt too. It's strange the things our minds create, and oh, to be both the axe and the tree, cutting through the branches of your mind. I know it doesn't have anything to do with what we had. Certain seasons with a meat and solitude. And I know, but still I'm wondering, can it make an exception for me? The river bed, I think this melancholy is kinda romantic. And in the stillness of unbending, and I'll get covered in mosquito bites, but I'm just glad that I could be a light source, or a little bit more. 'Cause oh, to be both the axe and the tree, cutting through the branches of your mind. And I know it doesn't have anything to do with what we had. Certain seasons with meat and solitude. And I know, but still I wonder. Song. This is called Talk About Love. Thank you. when you know, you know. Set on a white mare, ride an orphan too, into the garden of my unshapeable heart. Oh, what do we talk about when we talk about love? Is it like the first time that we met? Christmas tea in the middle of July, or is it where you said you read the junior magazine of the WWF as a kid, as I used to do, as I used to do. And I'm sure I could have seen it then, but I do. But I do see now. Oh, inside comes bursting in, and I'm sure it's what we talk about when we talk about love. To cycle through Western Germany. Love breaks apart, tell me where does love go? It's the side of the road down to your favorite story. Where all the other week I saw your sister and she still kinda scares me. And I'm sure I could have seen it then, but I do, but I do. Oh, inside it comes bursting in, how it's all that I seem to talk about. And I'm sure I could have seen it then, but I surely see it now. It's what we talk about, what we talk about.
My last song, and my hands are a bit frozen now. But thank you for listening. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm gonna release my first EP this year, so that's really exciting. And you can find it on Instagram, and my username is Maas is Maas, so you can find it. Thank you.
Construit, qu'on l'aura fini de nos propres mains. Quand on aura planté ses mâts bien tressés, qu'on verra de loin comme il sera beau. Toi, tu n'y croyais pas, mais il partira bientôt le grand bateau. Frères lointains qui souffrent de faim,
dans d'autres pays. Chacun apportera du blé ou du vin, du sucre ou du riz, comme il sera lourd. Toi qui n'as rien à toi, tu apporteras l'amour. Par milliers, debout sur un quai, le feront partie. Des hommes par milliers, sur un autre quai, le verront venir comme il était temps. Le monde aura fini de penser petit pour devenir grand.
Tekirdağ'ında bir çoban ateşi yanar. Zindanında özgürlüğe baş bağlayanlar. Zindanında özgürlüğe baş bağlayanlar. Hücresinde bir çin